Turning today to Paul's letter to the Ephesians, chapter 6 and verse 10. Ephesians, chapter 6 and verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. And you may notice that I am passing over chapter 5, verses 22 to chapter 6 and verse 9. That is the teaching on relationships, wives, husbands, children, fathers, masters or employers and servants, employees. And I'm transferring, if you don't mind, that section of verses into Wednesday evening. Well, this Wednesday we shall be looking at the teaching of David in the Psalms on the features of eternal glory of heaven. But then afterwards, God willing, I hope to embark on Wednesday on a brief series on these relationship chapters. But here on Sunday mornings, I'm passing directly to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10. And I read the words again, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord." And the subject is our spiritual warfare. And what a subject it is. Finally, says the apostle, finally. Well, you could translate it, and some do, and it's a shame, in conclusion. The Greek literally is just the rest. Regarding the rest, some would translate it. In conclusion. But although that's strictly the meaning of the term in the Greek, the rest, or finally, as we have it in our King James Version. Yet the Apostle Paul uses this word in a much stronger way than that. For example, in the very next letter, in Philippians, he uses it exactly halfway through the letter, finally, and then he uses it again towards the end. So he doesn't mean it to mean simply the remainder. In conclusion, he means it, he uses it to punctuate the sense. And when he is going to introduce final exhortations, a very great issue, in will come this word, finally. Almost as though, in his use, it has this sense. And last, but certainly not least. That's the sense in which the apostle uses it. And I mention that, you may feel it's a technical matter, because here it certainly introduces one of the most powerful themes of the whole epistle to the Ephesians. We've seen tremendous things doctrinally and practically, but now he comes to the Christian warfare. Finally, I move to a new topic, he seems to say. I move to something of such paramount importance. I conclude this letter with something so significant and vital to you. And so we're given an insight into mysterious and amazing things in the closing verses of the epistle. Finally, and then these words, my brethren, they are so important. They're in the received text. They're left out of nearly all, not all, but nearly all the modern translations, working from an inferior textual basis. And it's a great tragedy, because they're important. My brethren, says the apostle, and we have them here. I am with you, the apostle implies, I am with you in all I'm going to say to you and exhort you about. I'm going to warn you about the spiritual warfare. I'm going to exhort you to be so careful and to be strengthened by the might of Christ for this. I'm going to try to show you how this may be accomplished in your lives. But I call you my brethren because I want you to know, he implies, that I am with you in this need. I depend upon the strength of the Lord. I can do nothing without him. I've established that beyond all doubt. And I have proved him magnificently so many times. Those famous and wonderful words from 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verses 9 to 10. And this is the answer of the Lord to Paul when he pleads that his thorn in his flesh should be removed from him. And the Lord said, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." And Paul responds, "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong." And there are similar sentiments in his letter to the Philippians and chapter 4 and verse 11. Or I could read from verse 9, it's a longish portion, "Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me do, and the God of peace shall be with you. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, that now at the last your care of me hath flourished again, wherein ye were also careful, but ye lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned, in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed, both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me." My brethren, he says in Ephesians 6:10, "My brethren, I am with you in this need." And look at what the apostle accomplished. And look at what he went through. And look at the things that he bore. But all by the strength of Christ. "My brethren," he seems to me to be saying, "I feel for you. You are my brethren," and as one might exhort or plead with a brother or sister doing something dangerous, "I feel for you. These remarks are for you," he says, "because if you're not aware of the spiritual warfare, and if you don't take the right precautions, well, there'll be such heartache for you and such failure in life, and I plead with you as my brethren." And then he seems to be saying this in these words too, "My brethren, you know, only the regenerate know the spiritual warfare. Only those who have been truly converted, born again, and know Christ, know this spiritual warfare. Unconverted, we're like putty in the hands of the devil. He doesn't trouble us. We don't believe in him. His work towards us is so gentle, lest we should be scared, and by some intuition realize that there was a devil tempting us at work in our lives. So he handles us very discreetly. But unconverted, we do as we are tempted. We do according to our whims and desires, and those he plants in our hearts in a constant stream, and we're unaware of it. But once we're converted, it's open warfare, and all we want to do and accomplish for Christ, and all we strain towards, he opposes us and resists us. My brethren, it's only you, brothers and sisters, saved people, who know a spiritual warfare, and here's how you need the strength of Christ, and how you can handle it, and how you can stand and have victory. So these words, "my brethren," are really so important as the apostle tenderly introduces the subject. But here in the 10th verse, finally, last but certainly not least, "my brethren, be strong in the Lord." Now the deepest issue of all comes last in the epistle. The proving of us. A battle is portrayed, a mighty battle. Now, friends, there are some present here. I don't know how many. I would trust a minority, but there must be some who really do not take account of the spiritual warfare at all. And it may be that all of us fail to take account of the spiritual warfare at times. And this is the most dangerous thing of all. If you're a believer and you do not take account of the spiritual warfare, well, it'll be the worse for you. If you glide along easily in your Christian life and you think this is a very manageable life, happy all the day without any effort, without any fighting against sin, without any watching out for the temptations and the alluring things of Satan, moving perhaps from home to home, job to job, or whatever, without really feeling the need of his guidance and dependence upon him, happy as the day is long. You're a spiritual disaster. You may love the Lord. You may know his grace. Your spiritual accomplishments will be very small. Your spiritual usefulness to God. You'll know many, many falls. Your soul, your spiritual life will not be active as you may imagine. We need to take account of the battle, of the spiritual warfare. Now here, it's divided, I believe, into a number of aspects. And we won't yet go into them in detail. But there is a battle for the life of the soul. I am saved. But what is the state, my spiritual condition, the state of the soul? Am I cold? Or am I superficial? Is my love for Christ currently deep? Am I gratitude to him? What's going on in my soul? How is my prayer life? How earnest, how fervent, how much do I prove the Lord? How fervent is my ministry of intercession for others? How great my love for Christ. What is happening right now in my soul? And the devil is at work to chill and to ruin your spiritual life, the health of the soul and your closeness to Christ. And we see this in verses 13 and 18. Wherefore take unto you the whole armour of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, withstand growing cold, withstand distance from Christ and failure in prayer. And verse 18, praying always with all forms of prayer and supplication, and watching thereunto, and seeing the Lord's hand, and interceding for others, all saints, and elsewhere, we're told, for the lost as well. So, the life of God in the soul. And then here's another area where there's a tremendous battle. Well, for sanctification. The battle against personal sin, negatively, and the battle to see positive virtues cultivated and produced in our lives. Two sides. Temptation to sin, and to become kinder, better, more considerate, positively virtuous people. And the devil resists us all the way. And seeks to draw us aside. Why, there are people these days who lay claim to great gifts. And in charismatic circles, they talk about the giftedness of this one, the giftedness of that one. And some of their big-time preachers and leaders. And they claim supernatural gifts, imagined, of course. And yet you see them falling into sin, one after the other. Grievous sin, hitting the headlines in different parts of the world. And all the time, the devil is making nonsense of them, and they're losing the battle. Oh, the devil is trying to ruin our progress in sanctification. And there's a battle to be fought. Say some, no, there's no battle to be fought. Let Christ take it all over. Let go. Let God. And among the people who teach that kind of thing, There is constant failure and numerous falls. No, there's a battle by the help of God, strengthened in the Lord, but there's a battle nevertheless for us to fight against temptation and against sin. Then there's a battle for the gospel, for witness, for naming his name. How cowardly the devil makes us. How he distracts our minds. And Christian people who love Christ and feel sorry for lost souls end up saying nothing. No witness, missing opportunities, never looking for them. Nothing for him, no avenue of Christian service, all preoccupied with earning a living, furnishing the home, doing this, doing that, and nothing for the service of Jesus Christ. And Satan has won the battle. Then there's a battle for assurance. Of course there is. From time to time, the devil will try to take away our assurance and bring doubts into our hearts, even about our own standing, as a battle comes in there. And then there's a battle for the truth. Do you know why it is that so many churches, since maybe the beginning of the 1900s, and now have gone, Bible-believing churches, here in South London? If you could clamber into a time machine and go back to the year 1900, you will find evangelical, Bible-believing, gospel-preaching churches almost on every street corner and block of all denominations. And you could have entered into at least half of even the Anglican churches and found them low churches with the gospel being preached. And there would be numerous Methodist churches and numerous Baptist churches and the gospel being preached everywhere. Where have they gone? What's happened? How has the devil overthrown them? Taken away the truth so that the Bible was no longer believed and the congregations dwindled and the light went out and the place was sold up and knocked down or converted into a warehouse. Where have they all gone? Well, it was because the members, the people, and even the office bearers lost touch with the truth. They didn't defend it. They didn't value it. And when the devil sent in people that didn't believe it, and didn't believe the gospel and the word of God, people were not dismayed. People did not defend the truth. People didn't value it. First of all, they lost the doctrines of sovereign grace. And they believed a more shallow version of the gospel. Then they lost that. And finally, with the truth lost, God withdrew, and downhill it all goes. What about us? How many people here read doctrinal books, say at the beginning of their Christian lives, "Pastor, give me something to read. I want to know the doctrines. I want to know all the faith. I want to believe them with all my heart. I don't want to be a Christian all my life who only knows this much theology. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for dying on Calvary for me and saving my soul." That's wonderful. But you've got to know more, and you've got to know the faith and love it and study it and adore it. And then we defend it and we hold our ground. So there's a battle for the truth. And in these areas, the Apostle Paul, under inspiration, is going to give remedies and helps for us. "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood," he says, "but against principalities, against powers." Well, let's look at some of these things. "Finally, my brethren," verse 10, "be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might." Now, it seems to me there are two things in these verses. First of all, there's the exhortation to be strong, and then that is followed by the exhortation to put on the armour of God. It's kind of two stages. And this is how the old writers used to look at it, and the Puritan preachers. It's a kind of two-stage strengthening. Be strong in the Lord. The verb in the Greek is passive. It doesn't mean be strong yourself. Pull yourself together. Stand up, manifest some strength, be strong in the Lord. It's passive all the way. Ask him for the strength. You've got to exercise it when he gives it to you, but you must ask him for it and depend on him for it and look to him for it. So the verb is passive. Be strengthened might be a little better and communicate it to us a shade better. Be strengthened. That form tells us more clearly that we've got to get this strength from somewhere, not somehow summon it up within ourselves. Be strengthened in the Lord. And I try to explain it in this way. Imagine a soldier in ancient times, or in modern times, if you like. Then he's got his breastplate and his helmet and all the accoutrements of battle, of war, and he's got them on. Or today, he may have his body armour and his weapon. He may have night sight binoculars, every kind of modern equipment. But whether in ancient times or whether today, if he hasn't got the courage, he isn't going to be much of a soldier. However you dress him up, however sharp the sword, however good the automatic weapon, he needs courage. If he's sent into trees and attacking, forward movement, and he hides in the trees because he doesn't want to go forward, what's the good of all the body armour and all the equipment? And this is what the Apostle Paul is getting at. Before you put on the armour, be strengthened in the Lord. You're going to need the armour. What it symbolises, what it stands for, is going to be of enormous help to us. But even before you put it on, let's get our attitude right. In order to combat the enemy, the devil, we need desire, friends. Pray to the Lord for real desire. All the categories I've mentioned. I must desire life in my soul. O Lord, trouble my soul, that I will no longer be content to walk around as a lukewarm Christian. That I will no longer be able to bear it. Not to feel my need. Not to love my Saviour. Not to have gratitude to him, not to want to see him more clearly and know his blessing and his presence within. Give me a real desire for an ongoing engagement of soul and a fear of losing it and growing cold. So we need desire, just as the soldier needs courage. We need desire for these things. Ask the Lord to rouse your heart and give you a desire to watch your soul and to stay warm and fervent before the Lord and filled with prayer. Ask him for the desire. Then, we'll go on to other things that you need, but you certainly need desire. And then, like the soldier, you need some courage. Courage? Yes, courage and heroism. We need it as a Christian. Particularly for witness, as I mentioned already, how cowardly we can be, how easily we are quiet. Oh Lord, give me some courage. Give me boldness. I need it for witness. I need it for other things too. I may need it to defend the faith. It may be that I'm called upon to speak out, to defend some erosion of truth. And people may be quite hostile to me, even Christians, for doing so. Give me the grace, Lord, but also give me the courage to stand against the wiles of the devil. The best armour is no use without courage. And then I need something else. If I have the desire and the courage, I also need a settled determination to keep going in this war. Need determination to keep your devotions going, to form a habit and to stick to it, to always set aside that time, be it for you morning or evening, to call upon the Lord and give him that minimum of 15 minutes in prayer. bringing all your needs before Him, praising and thanking Him, interceding for others. Oh, there is so much to pray for, and yet how easily we can be distracted, and how foolishly we succumb. So we need determination, and we need determination to mortify the deeds of the body, to put to death our sins. What's your besetting sin? Maybe covetousness. Maybe desire for things, to spend more on this, to spend more on that, to look good, to have certain comforts beyond those that you reasonably need. And you recognize your besetting sin, whatever it may be. Maybe a temper, could be something like that. Could be a tendency to be dishonest, to exaggerate, to make excuses, to lie. And you need determination. Because when conscience sounds the alarm and you're about to commit that sin, oh yes, you want to resist it, but sometimes that article you're after, that something unnecessary and extra, seems so attractive, and so you push down the voice of conscience. You need determination, desire, courage, determination to resist sin. And to please the Lord, you need determination to maintain the truth. So, I mentioned just these things, and I mustn't stay with them. But, clearly, you need desire and courage for some of the things, and determination, and pray to God to give you all these things. And then, verse 10, we read, "Be strong in the Lord, and in the power of God. Of His might." And then verse 11, the second part, "Put on the whole armour of God." I'm not going to go into the elements of the armour today. Paul was in prison when he wrote this. He was in the Roman Praetorium. I imagine the guard was changed, as in ceremonial today, morning and evening. And he would have looked out of his small window and seen the soldiers. Indeed, there was a soldier in his room. And he was very, very familiar with the soldier's armour and equipment. And he uses the illustration of the soldier elsewhere. And here he details it for us and applies it spiritually, showing the help we can have from the Lord. But before we get to detail, put on the whole armour of God. In the Greek, the emphasis is on the whole armour. It's one word in the Greek. We have the Greek word surviving in the English language. The panoply, all the armour. Put on the whole armour is the emphasis of God. In the English, you might naturally think, put on the whole armour of God would be the emphasis. But it isn't in the Greek. It's put on the whole armour of God. For present purposes, that's what the apostle wants to emphasise. Don't focus on just some of the armour. Every piece is important. Don't focus just on one of the categories in the battle that we fight, but on all of them. Now, if I may give an example. Some years ago, there was a tremendous emphasis on assurance. 50s, 60s, very welcome, very necessary. But there was a tendency, certainly in more reform circles, for Christians to be fixing on the problem of assurance. And the spiritual warfare was seen almost solely in these terms. And if you'd have asked, what is the spiritual warfare? The answer could well have been, it's the devil's attempt to take away my assurance. So here's how you have to fight him on this ground. And it made us very preoccupied with ourselves. Here I am as a Christian, and what matters most is my assurance. No, says the apostle, put on the whole armour of God. It's a piece of armour for each category of the Christian life. Put it all on. The categories that I've been mentioning to you. The life of the soul. Am I alive in the soul? Praying, interceding, my love for Christ. It's not just my assurance. That's important. But that's only one category. Is it my sanctification, my battle against sin, and my cultivation of positive virtues for the Lord? Am I focusing on that too? And then is it the gospel? Is it all my assurance? Am I witnessing too? Am I concerned about my Christian service? And am I defending the truth? You see, you can make a mistake. You can pick just one aspect of the spiritual life. No, the whole armour of God is the emphasis for every category of spiritual living. And we need to think about these things. Some people do defend the faith. But truth, and this is important and precious and valuable, but truth is the one category they focus on. Not their lives, not their spirituality, nothing like that, not the gospel, but simply the defence of the faith. Well, that's grand, but what of the other four categories? They're all important to us equally. And there are some people, bless them, who are great witnesses, and they put us all to shame. And it's gospel, gospel, gospel. But be careful. The life is important, the spiritual life, the battle against sin and production of positive fruits of righteousness. All these things are important. So the apostle says quite firmly here in verse 11, put on, and you can underline this, this is the emphasis of the Greek, put on the whole armour of God, the panoply of God, weapons of defence, weapons of attack, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. The wiles of the devil. The devil's cunning methods is the sense of the original. Those are his wiles. You know, you've read about it, you know all about it. Years ago, there was a period of history during which armies did something which to us now seems extraordinary. They would assemble themselves in long lines, often dressed in full dress uniform, with shining helmets and bright scarlet uniforms, in an endeavour, you may think, to make themselves as conspicuous as possible. And they would present a broad front to the enemy and stand in long lines with their muskets, or before that, their archers, and so on. And the two armies would come together in long lines, fully exposed to each other. And then one side would fire a volley. And then the other side would fire a volley. And for a while, they'd take it in turns in these acts of slaughter. And we think back and think, why ever did they do that? And then people began to think of perhaps presenting a less obvious front to the enemy and engaging in skirmishes and dressing the soldiers up in nondescript uniforms so that they couldn't be so easily seen and so on. But for a time and a long period of history, you totally exposed yourself to the enemy and offered yourself to his fire. And took turns at that task. Amazing, we say. It wasn't the way it was done in earliest times, but it was the phase of history. Now the devil isn't going to come at you like that. He's not going to dress, as it were, in a scarlet uniform and a bronze helmet and form a long line of hosts and come at you obviously. His method is wiles, cunning methods. Assault by ambush. That's the method of the enemy of souls. Look at it in Ephesians here, chapter 4 and verse 4. I beg your pardon, verse 14. That we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. That is how the devil inspires his servants to behave, and his spiritual hosts also. It's sudden ambush when you're weak, when you're not expecting it, when he's ground you down gently. He is cunning. Look at it in the Garden of Eden. There, on possibly on the very first day, our first parents, and they're happy in all that God has provided for them, and the devil comes disguised, and he comes with great cunning, and he suggests this to them: God is jealous of you. God jealous of us? Oh yes. He doesn't want you to be his equal, as if you can be. He's jealous of you. He doesn't want you to know what he knows. And he's concealing things from you, and withholding things from you, and denying you. He's being unfair to you. And with such cunning, the devil comes in the guise of another, and works in the heart of our first parents. That's always his message: lies and deceit and cunning. Why, you need that super big car and that super big house. Not that anybody can afford these things now, but you need them, he says. Won't you look good? Won't you seem superior? Won't you be special to drive a Merc when everyone else is driving lesser things? Oh no, he won't say that to you. He'll come with cunning. You have that big place, these wonderful things. Oh, you'll have a witness to rich people. God will use you. Why, other Christians, they're not thinking about them. But you'll be able to have an outreach in a special way, in a unique way. Well, that's the way he comes, with cunning, in an ambush, to trip and to ensnare. The wiles of the devil, the cunning of his attacks. He's watching us all. He's watching you. In fact, did I say he is watching you? Paul leaves us in no doubt. It's the devil and his hosts. Vast numbers of fallen spirits are assigned. Who knows how many are watching you, looking for your weaknesses and your foibles and your inclinations to sin and your wrong desires, noting them all down in a system far more efficient than any of the electronic devices that we may hold in our hands, recording and noting everything so that superiors can plan and plot your downfall. Who can deal with this? Only by dependence upon the Lord and awareness of the battle, and we're going to see the help that God will give us. These are the things we're reading about. Finally, my brethren, in verse 11, put on the whole armour of God, that ye may be able to stand and triumph and resist him. Marvellously possible with the Lord. Stand against the wiles, the cunning methods of the devil. For we wrestle, it's a fight. We wrestle. We need the strength of the Lord, but we've got to engage. Not against flesh and blood, people, but against principalities, princes, prince generals, the highest ranks under Satan, who plan the battles and the strategy. Potentates, powers, these are the people who are the rulers of the darkness of this world. These are the people who design the pall of ignorance that is around the churches to maintain their control over people, pumping into society constantly sentiments against God, reasons to reject him, all the arguments of atheism or superstitious religion by way of alternative to the true faith. And their task is to design strategies. You can imagine them in their caverns with their drawing boards and their instruments planning how to keep society in darkness spiritually, how to keep society in sin. And they've got hosts of lesser demons to carry out their bidding. That is the picture. That's what we're against. So I conclude just with verse 13 this morning. This is really only introducing the subject. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armour of God, that ye may be able, it's gloriously possible, able to withstand him in the evil day, the day of special temptation, every day, and having done all to stand. What a wonderful, wonderful objective. So that the life of the soul is vibrant and warm, and prayer is meaningful, and we sense and know the Lord with us. So that the battle against sin is conducted, and virtues form in us. So that we have an avenue of service for the gospel, and we represent Jesus Christ, and we see fruit. So that we're assured of salvation, and happy in the things of God. And so that we really love the truth, and defend it, and keep it. And God will help us to get there, and keep us there. But we need the armour, and God willing, we'll study it as we go on. Let's close our worship with this most thoughtful.